evening and welcome behind the news for December 12th, 2002. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at economics and politics. And I've got two segments up for tonight. First, we'll speak with Sara Roy, economist who specializes in the Palestinian economy. She's just back from that part of the world, and we'll hear her report on what's going on there. And then at the bottom of the hour, an interview I recorded last week with Geisa Maria Rocha, who is a Brazilian and teaches at Rutgers, and she's going to be talking about the Lula regime and what it's inheriting in Brazil, what its prospects are, and such. So, we've got a very full plate tonight, so let's get started. Sara Roy is an economist, teaches at Harvard, and a frequent visitor to Palestine, the occupied territories. She's got an essay in the Verso collection, The New Intifada, which came out about a year ago, I guess, Resisting Israel's Apartheid. She's got an article, Decline and Disfigurement, the Palestinian Economy After Oslo. And read in today's Financial Times, there's an article that UN's appeal for Palestinian relief funds draws sighs from Israel and donors alike. And the director of the UN Relief and Works Agency, Peter Hansen, said, so rapid has been the humanitarian collapse, it will take an emergency program of the scale we present today to prevent a complete breakdown in Palestinian society. It looks rather dire. So let's hear from Sara Roy just what things are like. Is Palestinian society on the verge of a breakdown, Sara Roy?
Well, I can tell you that the situation is very bad, very grim, and probably the worst that I've ever seen in my 17 years or so of working and living and researching in this area. The economy suffered serious declines despite some intermittent periods of growth during the Oslo period. This is something most people don't realize. During the period of the so-called peace process, there were many economic problems. And, in fact, not only were old problems maintained or left relatively unaddressed, but there were new problems that were introduced that further weakened an already weak economy. And the primary factors introduced during that period were closure and also the fragmentation, the territorial fragmentation of Palestinian lands, which had a very direct and damaging impact on the economy. And certainly since the beginning of the current uprising, economic conditions have deteriorated even further. What is different about this period, the period of the Intifada, or since the Intifada, and the period preceding it, is not really a matter of substance, but a matter of scale. What you see today are many of the same problems, but taken to a much more acute degree, particularly with the intensification of closure policy, which is almost continuous, the imposition in many parts of the West Bank, in particular, of almost unending and uninterrupted curfew. You have the cutoff, basically, of Israeli employment to Palestinian labor. So you have rapidly rising levels of unemployment, and associated with that, of course, diminishing income levels, rising poverty levels, rising levels of child labor. And some new features that occurred since the current uprising is just the massive destruction of Palestinian infrastructure, the physical infrastructure of Palestinian society, of its institutions, of different aspects of the economy. And, you know, if you take these factors and many others together, you have a situation that is actually quite devastating. And I think that, you know, Peter Hansen's I've read various of his statements and reports and whatnot, is quite accurate. I mean, he uses alarmist language, but it is an alarming situation. And in fact, many of the studies issued in the last 18 months or so by the World Bank, for example, uses the same kind of alarmist language, which is very unusual for the World Bank because the situation is very critical.
And as I recall, during a month or two or three years ago, the World Bank was even upset that a lot of the infrastructure that had been financed was being destroyed by Israel. What is the World Bank's position?
The World Bank, they have issued a series of reports, and they're just about to issue, if they haven't already, another one. Documents this very clearly and says that, you know, most of the, for example, most of the $4 to $5 billion invested in the Palestinian economy since the beginning of the Oslo process has been lost. There has been almost $1 billion worth of damage done, physical damage, properties destroyed, buildings destroyed, agricultural land destroyed. Various other, damage, physical damage to the Palestinian areas that I think is close to about $800 million. Right now, the latest number I think I saw was $800 million. You have unemployment levels that are over 50% now overall, much higher in Gaza than they are in the West Bank. You have poverty levels that are approaching, the World Bank says that poverty by the, end of this year, they predict poverty to affect close to 60% of the Palestinian population, and other sources put it somewhat higher. So you have, a situation where the majority of people are living below the poverty line. At least half the population is dependent entirely on some sort of assistance, be it, food handouts, cash handouts, or some sort of external assistance. The access to employment is extremely limited. Before the Intifada, there were approximately, give or take, about 140,000 or 145,000 Palestinians working inside Israel, and today there are probably no more than, the number fluctuates, but there are probably no more than about 30,000. And sometimes that goes up, sometimes it goes down.
Can we review this history? I think in the early days of Israel, Palestinians were really not incorporated into the economy very extensively. Then they became so, and now they've been written out. So could you just review that history for us?
Well, when Israel took over or gained control of the West Bank and Gaza in 1967, they obviously became responsible for the economic welfare of the population, and the policy of the Israeli government throughout most of the occupation was to allow, obviously they had to provide people with a source of income, and that was done by incorporating to an ever greater extent Palestinian labor into the Israeli economy. There was a very conscious effort or policy on the part of the Israeli government not to allow the development of the Palestinian economy, of an indigenous domestic economy, but at the same time, obviously, they had to enable people to take care of themselves. So they did this by basically integrating the Palestinian economy into that of Israel's, making it very dependent upon employment and trade, employment in Israel and trade with Israel. And so throughout most of the occupation, the Palestinians became very dependent upon employment inside Israel and various economic activities with Israel.
And I'm guessing mainly in the low-wage sector?
Pardon?
Mainly in low-wage kinds of jobs?
Oh, yes, although the jobs were unskilled and semi-skilled labor, the kinds of jobs that most Israelis would not want to do. And with the dependence on the Israeli market has always been very, very high. And, with the first uprising that began in December of 87 and then the Gulf War and subsequent other events, the number of workers allowed into Israel would fluctuate depending upon the political situation. But the dependence, the structural dependence, was always very high. With Oslo, there was in the so-called peace process, there was a feeling or an expectation that ultimately this process would end this dependence and would allow Palestinians control over their own economy and although the Oslo agreements never called explicitly for a Palestinian state, many people hoped or assumed that the end point of this process would be a state, although that was a complete fallacy. And in fact, I've argued before and in some of my writings that Oslo, rather than attempting to end the occupation, was very much an attempt to maintain that occupation, albeit in a different form. And the idea was really it did not end Palestinian dependence on Israel, but in many compelling ways reinforced that dependence.
Now, the standard line, at least in the United States, is that Oslo was this promising period that the Palestinians irrationally rejected in favor of an uprising. You open your essay in the New Intifada collection by recalling that and dismissing it. So what is wrong with that standard line?
Well, there was a belief, and tragically, you know, most Israelis today do believe the mythology that especially emanated from the Camp David summit in July of 2000 between President Clinton, Barak, and Arafat, and the idea was that the Palestinians had been given this very generous, magnanimous offer by Barak, which they turned down, and this, in my view, and in the view of many other people, is a complete lie and a complete fallacy, because by the time, by the time of the Camp David summit, we were at sort of 7 years or more into, or 7 years, approximately 7 years into the peace process. And during that period of time, 50,000 acres of Palestinian land had been confiscated. Settlement expansion had grown exponentially. The number of settlers living on West Bank and Gaza lands had almost doubled from about 110,000 to 200,000. People, not including the Jewish settler community in and around Jerusalem. 250 miles of bypass roads, settler bypass roads, had been built on confiscated Palestinian lands. Closure had been introduced. Actually, closure was introduced before Oslo began, but was reinforced by the Oslo process, closure being the restriction on the movement of Palestinian labor and goods, not only between Palestinian areas and Israel, but within Palestinian areas and between the West Bank and Gaza as well. And perhaps the most egregious policy introduced during the Oslo years was this whole concept of territorial fragmentation, in which Palestinian lands were basically cut up into little enclaves, disconnected enclaves, and Palestinians were, they were trapped basically in these little enclave structures. And Israel, while Palestinians were given control over the enclaves, the areas in which they lived, they were not given control over borders. And the areas between the enclaves were controlled by Israel, which gave Israel control over the whole situation, which had enormous, and as I said earlier, and very damaging implications for the economy, because it took an already small economic base and cut it up even into smaller economic units, which was completely dysfunctional after a certain point, because Israel controlled all borders, both internal and external, and on top of that, you had, as I said, the steady confiscation of Arab lands. Much of those lands confiscated were viable agricultural lands, and I might add this confiscation was written into the second Oslo Agreement and had the express approval of Yasser Arafat. So there were a variety of processes, mainly this one and closure, which had did great damage to the economy despite all the rhetoric one hears about, the peace process and prosperity and whatnot. There were periods, intermittent periods of growth. But again, the growth was not a function of economic reform within the Palestinian economy, but it was a function of Israel's easing closure policy and allowing a freer movement of labor and goods in and out. And as soon as Israel clamped down or tightened closure, then that ended. So the growth that did occur was, again, entirely a function of Israeli policies. And Israel could, in a sense, turn the spigot on, and it can turn the spigot off. So by the time the Intifada broke out, and many of the reasons why the Intifada broke out was because by the time of the Camp David summit, what was being offered to the Palestinians was territorially cut up, disconnected a set of enclaves in which Palestinians had no control over their borders, internal or external, in which all their resources, their labor, their land, their water, was under the direct or indirect control of Israel. Settlements had expanded, you know, at a very rapid rate. You know, tens of thousands of acres of land had been taken, et cetera, et cetera. So what the Palestinians were offered was totally unacceptable to them. In fact, Yasser Arafat, who, you know, I feel is a traitor to his own people, even Arafat at the end could not have swallowed this agreement because he knew that this would be totally, totally unacceptable to his population. And so this was, you know, I'm certainly glossing over many details, but this was, in a sense, the context from which the Intifada arose. I mean, life had just become quite untenable for people, and their freedom of movement, their ability to take care of themselves and their children had diminished considerably. Unemployment was rising, poverty levels were rising. This was before the Intifada, and conditions were quite bad. This is not something that was talked about a great deal or certainly dealt with explicitly by the media or various policy circles, but in fact was clearly taking place. So once the Intifada broke out, of course, all the weaknesses built into the economy just broke down because the economy was clearly unable to sustain the massive pressures imposed by Israel since that time, particularly in terms of intensified closure and curfew and restricting the number of people who can work and the levels of trade and so on and so forth.
We're listening to Sarah Roy, the economist who specializes in Palestinian economy. What has Israel done to replace the Palestinian workers who now can't enter the country?
Well, you know, for the last few years, and for several years before the current uprising, the Israeli government has been importing labor from other countries, from Romania, from Thailand, from different parts of Eastern Europe. And there are approximately 300,000 laborers from these areas, both who are working in Israel, both legally and illegally. And again, this was part of a policy that Israel implemented years ago, which was designed to limit Israel's dependence, in that sense, on Palestinian labor, or wean Israel of dependence. And it was dependent on Palestinian labor in certain sectors, such as construction. And this was part of a policy that actually began in 1991. During the Gulf War. But over the years, the number of foreign laborers who have come to Israel to work has grown dramatically. And, most Israeli employers, I don't know if it's still the case today, but up until not long ago, still preferred Palestinian workers because there was a cultural familiarity, there was a history there. And at night, Palestinians went home. You know, they didn't live in Israel. They weren't allowed to. And they went home to the West Bank or to Gaza. The current labor force, foreign labor force, stays there and obviously lives there. And it's created many problems for Israeli society. And it's also created certain economic issues and problems, although it has generated, for certain sectors of the Israeli economy, I think I read close to $3 billion for the economy. So it's an extremely profitable venture for certain sectors of the economy. And you have, again, I can't emphasize enough how devastating the loss of employment has been for Palestinians. Remember, you have an economy, a Palestinian economy, that for the last 30 or more years or so has been made very dependent on employment and on trade with Israel, and suddenly that employment is not suddenly, but over the last few years has diminished, and in the last couple of years has diminished quite dramatically, with no alternatives or very few alternatives. West Bankers, to a certain number of West Bankers can return to agriculture, subsistence agriculture. Gazans don't have that option. And so you have people who basically, if they can't find work domestically and their own domestic economies are quite weak, and or if they can't find employment in the Palestinian public sector, which is now a very critical employer, they have no employment. And so not only do unemployment levels rise dramatically, but the number of people dependent on those people who can work has grown from about 5 dependents per worker to about 9 dependents per worker. So you have an escalating problem. And, of course, as Palestinian workers lose income from you know, the loss of jobs inside Israel, this, of course, affects the domestic economies in a very real and dramatic way as well, because they have less money to spend in those economies. So then those economies have to lay off some of their workforce because they're not generating any income. So it has, there's a domino effect, and it's had a devastating result. I mean, Palestinians, since the Intifada, over half the population has lost, at least I believe, I think has lost about half of, I can try to find the number, according to the World Bank, 56.5% of all Palestinian households have lost more than half their income since before the uprising. And according to the World Bank as well, by the end of June of this year, of 2002, almost as many jobs that were created in the five-year period through September 2000, when the Intifada began, which was approximately 220,000 jobs, have been lost. And 50,000 jobs were lost in the second quarter of this year alone. So
how are people getting by? I mean, this sounds very dire. How do people just survive from day to day?
Well, people survive, first of all, UNRWA and other UN agencies are very critical in providing cash assistance. And
I just learned in that Financial Times article that Israel actually takes a cut of the money coming into UNRWA.
That I didn't know, yeah.
Yeah,
I didn't
it's just amazing, yeah. Taxing relief money.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, UNRWA provides sources, other international agencies, you know, the donor community has provided relief. But, of course, this is finite, and it's unclear how long this can go on. People help each other, but that's becoming increasingly difficult because everyone's in the same boat. So people will share with each other, and those Palestinians who are lucky enough to have relatives working and living abroad can survive, but then that money is used to support many more people than it was, 2 years ago or 5 years ago or certainly 10 years ago. So there are fewer resources and more people dependent on those resources. So people have been forced to sell, personal belongings just simply to buy food. The food is there, but people don't have the money to buy it. And people are forced basically to liquidate their assets to the extent that they can. And it's a very grim situation. And, people also have less money, of course, as I said, to buy food, which has had direct implications on their ability to feed themselves and, more importantly, to feed their children. Malnutrition rates are extremely high. They are 22, according to CARE and I think a study done by CARE and together with the Johns Hopkins University, found that 22% of children, Palestinian children below 5, suffer from chronic and acute malnutrition. And the situation is particularly bad and dangerous in Gaza, where over 13% of children under 5 suffer from acute malnutrition, which is a very serious problem. And this is a rate that the World Bank says is comparable to that of sub-Saharan Africa. In fact, it's higher than the rate found in Zimbabwe and just below the rate found in the Congo. So, Peter Hansen saying that, children are in a very dangerous situation, and you have now a very serious problem, or increasingly serious problem among Palestinian children with micronutrient deficiencies, which cause children, this is, you know, essentially malnutrition, which cause children to fail to grow and develop normally, and their cognition is damaged, and sometimes this is irreversible. Their immune systems are compromised, their mental and physical capacities are impaired, and these numbers are growing. The 22% is based on studies done several months ago, and as the situation grows worse, one can only expect that, you know, these problems will become more acute. And this is, you know, it's extremely dangerous. I mean, people here don't really have a clear sense of what is going on. And another very important problem is the fact that the Israeli government is withholding hundreds of millions of dollars that it owes the Palestinian Authority. Two-thirds of the Palestinian Authority budget comes from transfers, you know, monies collected by Israel, and that it is obligated to transfer to the Palestinian Authority according to the economic protocol, which is the economic agreement under Oslo between Israel and the Palestinian Authority. And, you know, these monies now, I think, are in excess of $700 million, have been withheld since December of 2000, I believe. And the Israelis, I think, have transferred about $30 million of that more than $700 million in the last few months, but that's it. So obviously those monies could go a long way, too, if transferred to help alleviate the problems, but they are being withheld. And on top of that, too, you have a situation where the Israeli government now is imposing more and more restrictions on the movement of people and goods, and they are introducing new travel permit systems between Palestinian localities, and again, the movement between Gaza and the West Bank has virtually been cut off. Movement within these territories has been severely affected, and now the Israeli government is building a security wall, and this is intended as a permanent structure, and it's intended to be around 217 miles long, which is over twice as long as the Berlin Wall, and it costs about $1 million per kilometer, and it's about 349 kilometers to build. And I've seen parts of it. It's absolutely astounding. And in some cases, you know, this wall sort of juts into the West Bank and cuts off, I mean, really literally cuts off one Palestinian area from another. And in some cases, it appears that, you know, certain Palestinian communities are going to be caught between the wall and the border of the West Bank in Israel. I mean, the whole thing is Orwellian, and it's, in my view, obscene, and of course is not going to do anything to increase Israel's security, but to the contrary, will diminish Israeli security, because it's going to create an even more untenable situation for Palestinians, not only economically, but socially and physically.
Okay, I'm afraid we have to end it there. Thank you for joining us, Sarah Roy.
Thank you.
And we'll be in touch again.
Okay, thanks so much.
And we'll take a little break, take a little musical break, and I'll be back in a moment to hear about Brazil. Hybrid of art and pop, Fisher Spooner remixing Kylie Minogue, and sometimes it seems a bit of a shock to follow a rather gloomy-sounding interview with some upbeat-sounding music, but need a little relief from the gloom now and then. The station WBAI 99.5 FM, New York. My name is Doug Henwood. The show is Behind the News. And now, an interview I recorded about 6 days ago with Geza Maria Rocha, who teaches at Rutgers University and author of a very interesting article in New Left Review, the July-August issue, on neo-dependency in Brazil, history of the recent Brazilian political economy. With the new government of Lula taking office in January, all eyes are on Brazil and just what Lula and his government can and will do. The early signs are not all that promising. He had nominated as his finance minister Antonio Palocci, who promised a very austere and orthodox economic policy. The central bank nominee is left a job with a U.S.-based bank, Fleet Financial, and also promises orthodoxy. And over the weekend, the IMF praised Brazil's leader, Lula, as really a leader for the 21st century. So the early signs are not good, but let's listen to some of the background and Geisha Rocha's prognosis for the Lula regime.
Welcome to WBAI. The new government of Brazil is getting ready to take office. What kind of society, what kind of economy are they inheriting now?
Well, as a matter of fact, President-elect Lula has a big dilemma in front of him. The issue is that, what is he going to do? Is he going to keep his pledge to the Brazilian people for social change? Or he's going to please the markets with an ultra-tight fiscal policy to produce the primary surplus that the International Monetary Fund is demanding. Just to say this means that he is inheriting a very bad situation from the Cardoso's government in terms of the public debt and in terms of the external debt. The public debt, if you want me to go on, just explain that the public debt right now is about 800 billion reais. And the most important is that it's almost about 60% of the GDP. So for him to keep on servicing that debt, he's going to have, as I said, to adopt a very fiscal policy, which means that he's not going to be able to keep the promises to the Brazilians, the overwhelmed majority that vote for change. That's his dilemma right now, and this is as a result of what he is inheriting from the Cardoso government. It's a bomb.
Yeah, the sounds coming out of the people around him over the last few weeks have been rather conventional. I mean, his transition advisor used the word very austere to describe the budget they're planning they want to run. Primary surpluses, as you say. Is this for real, or are they just saying these things to calm nerves?
Well, I would expect, you know, from my point of view, that this is to calm down the markets. But in any event, okay, the issue is the International Monetary Fund loan of $30 billion. The International Monetary Fund is very smart in the sense that the fund only gave $6 billion to this government, to Cardoso's government, and the $24 billion for 2003 is conditioned to the production of the primary surplus. And the situation is so bad that the Lula's government will be needing this $24 billion. So that, you know, to keep the external accounts tight. But therefore, Lula will have to produce this primary surplus, otherwise the fund is not going to be releasing the tranches of the loan. So it is a big dilemma. And as you said, yes, Antonio Palocci, who is the Workers' Party man in charge of the transition, and rumors have that he might be the finance minister. Indeed, he is keeping a very austere face to the markets, so to speak, that the government, that Lula's government, to be austere and so on. You're correct. Now, the issue is whether this is going to be policy as of January 1st, or if it's just to calm down the markets. But let me just say one thing. As of this week, there has been another round of devaluation because the markets, I mean the foreign investors or domestic investors, are nervous that the Workers' Party is not really producing the people that are supposed to be in charge of, for instance, of the central bank and so on. They were expecting the nomination soon this week, and nothing came. So we see now another round of devaluation, another round of falling in Brazilian risk in the financial agencies, risk agencies, and so on. So the situation is, I think, the economic plight is serious.
I'd like to return to the issue of Lula's prospects at the end of the interview, but let's talk a little bit about what created the situation he's inherited. Could you talk about Cardoso, his government, and the kinds of policies he followed?
Yes. I would say that everything began with the Plano Real in 1994, and with the opening, completely opening of the country to foreign capital, not only multinationals for direct investment, but particularly speculative loans, because Real was a very strong currency that needed a lot of reserves, foreign reserves, and the government started opening the country for foreign capital to increase the reserves. And then what happened was that the currency became overvalued, which meant that Brazil began having a massive trade deficit, which in turn needed more foreign capital, and which in turn increased the current account deficit, because foreign capital, after all, needs to be rewarded with interest payments and the repatriation, profit repatriation. And in turn, it was a vicious circle. In turn, a new round of foreign indebtedness began, and right now we have about $230 billion in foreign loans. So it was, everything began, as I said, with the strong currency of real to reduce inflation and the need of foreign capital to support that strong currency. And then Brazil began being vulnerable to external shocks. It started with the Asia crisis in 1997. And then the currency collapsed altogether in 1998. And then the International Monetary Fund comes into the picture with a $45 billion rescue package demanding the primary surpluses. And the country became absolutely at the mercy of the International Monetary Fund as of 1999. So what Lula is inheriting is the result of the policy of ultra-neoliberal policies, I would say, of the Cardoso government, opening completely the country to foreign capital. Because, of course, all developing countries need a dose of foreign capital because our savings are not as high, but not completely just screaming opening. Capital could come in, capital could come out with absolute no controls. And as a result of this, and then, of course, during the crisis, the financial crisis, the government had the response was high interest rates, which absolutely increased the internal debt. And as I said, it was a vicious circle, increasing the foreign debt, increasing the internal debt, and increasing the external vulnerability of the country. And I believe that in the sum is what Cardoso did.
You wrote in your New Left Review article that as President Cardoso sought explicitly to make the Brazilian economy as dependent as possible on the multinationals and financial institutions of the core in order to develop the country. But in doing so, he invited multiple contradictions, which as a theoretician he could have he should have foreseen.
Yes.
First, could you talk about his intellectual history, what kind of theoretician he was? And
Cardoso was a man of the left, I'm sure you realize it, and he's very famous for his dependence theory. He wrote a book with Enzo Faletto, another sociologist from Chile, and the book is very famous, Dependency and Development in Latin America, which he meant at the beginning of my article. As a matter of fact, I'm going to quote here what I said at the very beginning. The major thesis of Cardoso is in the very first paragraph of my article, in which I said that, Cardoso entered political life as a high prolific critic of dependent development, famous for arguing that, this is the major thesis, while the bourgeoisie in Brazil was incapable of leading a successful program of independent industrialization, the Association of National with International Capital in the periphery of the world system would not lead, and that's the issue, would not lead to conversion of third world metropolitan societies. He argued that it would, on the contrary, perpetuate deep socioeconomic inequalities, loss of control of the direction of national development, and vulnerability to external financial shocks. In other words, he knew that opening up completely the economy for foreign capital would bring those contradictions. He was aware of it when he was a sociologist, and yet, once he became a politician, the president of Brazil, he did precisely what he condemned and criticized vehemently in his theory.
In other words, the strategy was, which he had initially criticized and then embraced, was that foreign capital would take the place of domestic capital, domestic savings, and foreign capitalists would take the place of a domestic capitalist class, which was incapable of launching development on its own, right?
Well, no, not really. What he said is that the association, not taking completely, association of national and international capital. That is the whole thesis of his dependence theory, okay? That industrialization, the periphery of the world system, would be characterized by an association, alliances of international or foreign capital, the state at the time of when the state was active in the economy, and national capital. This is what he said. But what I showed in my article, that the way he's updating dependent development, international capital completely wiped out national capital in Brazil with the privatization of state enterprises and with the merger and acquisition, okay? And they became very vulnerable, the national capitalists in Brazil, precisely because of the high interest rates and the completely opening of the economy trade-wise, okay, they could not compete with the import products in addition to the very high interest rates. That made national capital very vulnerable, and the multinationals took over completely. In other words, it was the results of Cardoso, the outcome of Cardoso's policy was even more radical than what he had foreseen in his theory.
Why do you suppose that Cardoso, the politician, forgot what Cardoso, the sociologist,
knew? Well, actually, he didn't forget. As a matter of fact, there is a saying in Brazil, I don't know if it is true or not, that Cardoso once said that as soon as he became president, he said, forget what I wrote, okay? He denies ever saying this, but the media report at the time. Now, there are many explanations for this, okay? He's his apologetics, his supporters argued that he became very pragmatic, okay? They call him a very pragmatic man, and that given the situation in Brazil, that he had no other choice but opening up the economy. And some critics say, no, he shouldn't have done that. Opening completely the foreign capital should be more selective, like Asia. In the end of my article, I compare the developed outcomes of the state-led development in Brazil, okay, which was by far superior, and also showed that in the case of Asia, they were very selective, South Korea, for instance, very selective in opening for foreign capital and opening for foreign loans and so on. But answering back your question, that yes, some say that he was pragmatic, but there is something else that I must say to you. The Washington Consensus, okay? As I mentioned also in my article, one of the conditions for the restructuring of the foreign debt, you know, coming back from the debt crisis in 1982, the lost decade and so on, you know, that one of the conditions was the Braid Plan and the Baker Plan, that the countries should open the economy, okay? Take the state out completely, you know, end the era of state intervention, opening the countries for foreign capital and trade and so on. Market-friendly approach. And I would suggest that was the same reasoning, the rationale of Cardoso. If he wanted to really implemented the Plano Real, and if he wanted to have a strong currency, he would need foreign capital. And foreign capital would only flow to countries that were implementing the Washington Consensus. So I would, that's the way I would put it. And it's a pity. It's a pity because we needed to reduce inflation, which the Real plan accomplished. But it was at a tremendous sacrifice to the country, as I try to show in my article. And as a matter of fact, right now, inflation is coming back again. I don't know if you realize it, but we are already in 10%, and which means that Lula, in addition to all of the problems that I mentioned, the structural problems inherited from Cardoso, he's also inherited inflation. 10%. And this is very serious because, as you know, our interest rates right now is 22%, which is one of the highest in the world. And how is Lula going to deal with inflation creeping up in the economy? Increase the interest rates again? If he increases interest rates, that's going to be more stagnation for the Brazilian economy. So he is in a very difficult situation inherited by Cardoso. And I just want to say one thing to finalize. I think it was, indeed he stabilized the economy in terms of reducing inflation, but I would characterize this plan as unstable stabilization, okay? A very unstable stabilization, if I could say that. The real collapse in 1999 now is the lowest ever level since its inception, with a massive devaluation in this year of 2002 of more than 60%.
And if he was aiming to be pragmatic, judged by pragmatic standards, didn't work very well.
Well, this is what his apologists say. I'm not saying that he was. That's what his supporters say. Pragmatism that led him to do this. That's not how I see it. I think it was unpatriotic what he did to the economy and to the people. The opening of the economy, the neoliberal reforms, and so on. I think it was very unpatriotic. And as you can tell, the people in Latin America have already beginning to say that these reforms are enough, okay? They did not produce absolutely any improvement in the living standards. Lula was the first. Now comes Ecuador with Gutierrez, and also problems in Peru, and you can say that we are at the end of the Washington consensus and the neoliberal reform.
Now, of course, the markets and the IMF and the people who make up the Washington consensus want to see very conventional austere policies coming out of the new government, especially austere, just to reassure them because of their political uncertainty over Lula's affinities. So what do you expect? Is he going to have to satisfy the foreign markets and the IMF, or is he going to have to answer to his domestic constituency?
Well, that's how I began this conversation with you, is a major dilemma. He cannot please two masters, okay? But at the same time, we have to understand what he inherits. He's going to have somehow to produce some primary surplus. The demand of the International Monetary Fund for 2003 is 3.75 of GDP. But it is very possible that in the next meeting that the IMF is going to have with Brazil to review, the next review of the agreement in February, is very possible that the International Monetary Fund is going to demand a higher primary surplus. And in my opinion, Lula cannot accede to that. But you were saying that you have been, hearing things from Brazil that this transition guy, Antonio Palocci, is beginning to try to calm down markets by saying that the administration is going to be very austere. But what can I tell you? What I tell you is this: if that happens, Lula is going to be disappointing the country.
And, what kind of domestic reaction would you expect from Brazilians? Would we see something like the kind of rebellion we saw in Argentina? Or what would you expect if Lula ends up being too friendly towards the IMF?
Oh, what you're trying to establish a parallel between Lula and De La Rua. In other words, people wanted De La Rua to change, and De La Rua just continued the policy, which was disastrous. Isn't this what you're trying to say? Well, I certainly hope, the only thing I can tell you now, I just hope that we didn't vote for the continuity of the same policies, okay? That's what I would say to you, that Brazilians did not vote for continuity. Brazilians vote for change. Now, as to the extent to which the people would go to the streets and challenge the government, as the Argentinians did with De La Rua, I do not believe that, because Brazilians are usually not as that, Brazilians are very mild, so to speak. I do not see massive throngs of people in the streets demanding an end of the government. I simply don't see that with my people. They are just not like this. It's not traditional of Brazil. But that's going to be absolute a disappointment if Lula does not bring the changes that we have requested, we have demanded.
What can you tell, say about the makeup of the Workers' Party? Is it really a very working class party? Is it more mixed, more middle class influences? And how radical is the constituency?
Oh, well, I would say to you that most of the Workers' Party constituency is the public employees. You know, it's actually middle class. Some people don't have much of that sense. But it's true. Government employees and middle-class people, they are the ones that are the major, I would say, constituency of the Workers' Party in Brazil. And as you know, the public employees have been very unhappy with Cardoso throughout these 8 years. They hardly got any increase in their salary. And massive unemployment, laying off public employees as a result of the IMF stringent policy and so on. Now, in terms of the radical wing of the Workers' Party, yes, there is a radical wing that is not really in support of what the Palocci, for instance, Antonio Palocci, has been projecting to the markets, okay? We have to see that, too. There are two sides of the Workers' Party. There's a moderate side, a moderate wing, in which Lula is prevailing, and there is a more radical side, a wing of the Workers' Party. So we have to see how it develops, which one is going to prevail. But so far, Lula has been prevailing. You have to understand that Lula is a great negotiator, okay? And in addition to everything, let me just say that Brazilians are not radical, okay? And for Lula to come to power is the first ever elected leftist to the presidency in Brazil. The first one, Goulart, was the vice president. He was not elected. Lula had to really come to a middle ground, so to speak, okay? And I believe that's how he got elected, because he became more moderate. Now, the issue is whether he's going to keep his moderation to please the markets, or he's going to go more to a left side to please those who voted for him. That remains to be seen.
And do you have any sense of which way it's going to go?
Me? The only sense that I have, believe me, I hate to say this, I'm just an observer, you know, very closely watching everything that's happened. The only thing with certainty that I have to tell is this. If the International Monetary Fund withholds this $24 billion, Brazil will have to declare a moratorium on its foreign debt, you see. So I want to give you a sense that... unfortunately, I hate to say this, but I believe that Lula is going to try to really continue this commitment with the International Monetary Fund to prevent a further deterioration in the external accounts of Brazil. That's how I feel. I'm not happy to say this, but given the situation that he's inheriting, without this $24 billion, I don't believe that external accounts of Brazil will be closed. Even though I must say this to you, that this year of 2002, as a result of the massive devaluation, for the first time since the real was established, we are having a very sizable trade surplus in the balance of payments, about $11 billion. It is not enough to close the external accounts of Brazil. So Lula needs this $24 billion from the International Monetary Fund.
Finally, you said earlier that it seemed as if the era of neoliberalism and the dominance of the Washington Consensus in Latin America was over. Does anybody have an idea of what comes next?
I would like to risk by saying that while the state will no longer be a producer, okay, because at the time of state intervention in the economy, the state had two roles. One was regulator with high tariff walls. The other one was a producer getting involved in state enterprises. I would say that the state as a producer, I believe that's not going to happen anymore. But I venture to tell you that that's going to be a more active role for the state from now on. The state is going to be very much intervening in terms of education, health care, and even in tariff. Because then we have to talk about the free trade area of the Americas. We have to see that here in the United States, there is a lot of protectionism also on the agricultural sector. It's steel, in the case of Brazil, orange, and steel and sugar, tobacco, all face very, very, very high tariffs. So I believe that in this sense, that will be room for the state to get more involved in trade matters and also in an industrial policy. Yes, what I see is that a more interventionist state, okay, in kind of in promoting a more nationalist policy. I see a more nationalist policy coming out of Latin America, not only of Brazil, but Venezuela, Brazil, and Argentina, and Ecuador, possibly a little bit from Chile. A little more interventionist state, a little bit more of a nationalist policy.
Well, that wouldn't make Washington very happy. Thank you for joining us.
And that was Geza Maria Rocha, who teaches at Rutgers University and has a piece in the July-August New Left Review on neo-dependency in Brazil, which you can get on the web at newleftreview.net, newleftreview, all one word, .net. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on to the evening, and let's go out with a little more of that art hybrid, and till next week. Bye.